Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
East African countries to send troops to South Sudan. AMISOM forces in Somalia expand operations against Al-Shabaab. I'm Ira Melman reporting from Washington. East African countries have agreed to send troops to South Sudan to help enforce a shaky ceasefire deal between the government and rebel forces. The announcement came Thursday at a summit of the East African Regional Bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development in Ethiopia's capital of Addis Ababa. Reporter Marta van der Wolf, who is covering the summit for VOA, says the troops will protect IGAD ceasefire monitors and could also be used to protect oil fields. She says they are not expected to protect civilians. Ethiopia, Kenya, Burundi, and Rwanda will contribute soldiers to the force, whose size was not announced. Seyoum Misfin, the chief mediator of peace talks between South Sudan's warring factions, said the troops should begin arriving by the middle of April. African Union forces say they've reclaimed more territory from the al-Qaeda-linked militant group al-Shabaab in renewed military operations across Somalia. The AU peacekeeping force in Somalia, known as AMISOM, said Thursday that Djiboutian soldiers have taken control of territory in Hiran region north of the capital, extending recent military gains. VOA's Somali service reports that Djiboutian, Ethiopian, and Somali troops recaptured Beleborbe, a town in Hiran about 125 kilometers north of Mogadishu. North Korea is denying responsibility for an oil tanker that loaded crude from a Libyan rebel-held port and escaped the government's attempt to seize it, saying the vessel that carried its flag was linked to an Egyptian company. A senior official from North Korea's Maritime Administration said Thursday the tanker had violated its laws and a contract with the Alexandria-based Golden East Logistics Company by carrying contraband cargo. Jean Ki Choi said Pyongyang had notified Libya and the International Maritime Organization and severed all association with the ship. He said the North had temporarily allowed Golden East Logistics to use its flag under a six-month contract signed in late February, and the company ignored its demand to leave the rebel-held Asidra port without loading oil. China's premier says his country will need guts and wisdom to handle the broad range of economic, political, and diplomatic challenges it's grappling with this year. In a wide-ranging speech, the premier also suggested there is friction with the United States and the two countries should respect each other's core interests.
Premier Li Keqiang spoke at the closing of the National People's Congress in what was his first news conference after China unveiled an ambitious agenda for economic reform last year. China's leaders are trying to move the economy away from a three-decade-old mode of development focused on state-backed enterprises. The model has created tremendous wealth but also led to corruption and inefficiencies. It has also made things more difficult for private enterprises. On Thursday, Li said the government is making progress in encouraging new private businesses by streamlining hundreds of transactions. Rebecca Valley for VOA in Hong Kong.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Russia risks massive political and economic damage if it does not change course in the Ukraine crisis.
Eines muss dabei aber unmissverständlich klar sein.
In a speech to the German parliament Thursday, Ms. Merkel said Ukraine's territorial integrity is not up for discussion. The West and Russia have been locked in a tense standoff over Russia's military incursion into Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. U.S. President Barack Obama warned Russia again Wednesday that the West will apply costs to Moscow if it continues to interfere in Ukrainian affairs. Malaysian officials have denied reports that a missing passenger jet continued flying for hours after its last known contact and say Chinese satellite images do not depict any debris from the aircraft. The transportation minister said Thursday that Malaysian Airlines asked the plane's maker, Boeing, and engine manufacturer, Rolls-Royce, about purported data showing the plane could have flown an extra 4,000 kilometers over 4 hours.
I would like to refer to news reports suggesting that the aircraft may have continued flying for some time after last contact. As Malaysian Airlines will confirm shortly, those reports are inaccurate.
The report by the Wall Street Journal on Thursday cited the belief of U.S. officials based on data that is automatically sent by the airplane's engines to the ground. Learn more at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
The international community is warning South Sudan faces a possible famine if the conflict there is not quickly brought to an end.
That's reporter Marta van der Wolf in Addis Ababa. Details next. Also, Somali and African Union forces say they have reclaimed more territory from the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. A recently issued briefing highlights the effects of violence, conflict, and disasters on girls' lives, including education. And a new report says ending persistent hunger and undernutrition should be top development priorities. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, East African countries have agreed to send troops to South Sudan to help enforce a shaky ceasefire deal between government and rebel forces. The announcement came today at a summit of the East African Regional Bloc IGAD in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. The troops will protect IGAD's ceasefire monitors and could also be used to protect oil fields. They are not expected to protect civilians. Ethiopia, Kenya, Burundi, and Rwanda will contribute soldiers to the force. The size of the force was not announced. Seymoun Mesfin, chief mediator of peace talks between South Sudan's warring factions, said the troops should begin arriving by mid-April. The fighting and ethnic violence sparked by the conflict have killed thousands and caused nearly a million people to flee their homes. Meanwhile, the international community is warning South Sudan faces a possible famine if the conflict there is not quickly brought to an end. Marta van der Wolf has more from a summit of East African states in Addis Ababa.
South Sudan's government and rebel forces signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in January, but fighting continues and peace talks in Addis Ababa have made little progress. U.S. Special Envoy Donald Booth expressed his concerns about the situation Thursday during the extraordinary summit of the East African Bloc IGAD, which has been mediating the peace talks between South Sudan's warring factions. Booth says there's deep disappointment that neither side is respecting the ceasefire.
This failure has led to thousands of additional deaths and an ever-worsening humanitarian situation, with South Sudan facing a possible famine.
The rainy season is approaching South Sudan, but many fields remain unplanted because people have been chased from their homes and are afraid of being attacked if they return. 85% of South Sudanese households are believed to be engaged in pastoral farming and depend on livestock and agriculture. With the rainy season just weeks away, European Union Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Alexander Rondos, says urgency is needed to avoid a famine.
If people cannot go and plant, there will not be sufficient stocks within months. Livestock, a large proportion of the livestock population of a country populated by so many people who have pastoralist economy, is lost. It is absolutely essential that all the necessary steps be made.
The fighting in South Sudan between forces of the president and his former vice president has left tens of thousands of people dead and displaced nearly a million. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Somali and African Union forces say they have reclaimed more territory from the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab in renewed military operations across Somalia. Restoring the government's political authority remains a pressing challenge. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow reports.
The AU peacekeeping force in Somalia, known as AMISOM, said Thursday that Djiboutian soldiers have taken control of territory in Hiran region, north of the capital, extending recent military gains. AMISOM spokesman Colonel Ali Hamoud.
There are small towns to which Djiboutians are moving, but the objective is far beyond that.
VOA's Somali service reports that Djiboutian, Ethiopian, and Somali troops recaptured Bolaburbe town, about 125 kilometers north of Mogadishu. In the past week, Ethiopian soldiers under AMISOM retook control of several key towns in southwestern Somalia. Somali officials said in some cases, Al-Shabaab had fled from their positions before confronting the advancing soldiers. The current operations represent the most significant progress regional forces have made against the militants since 2012, when the Kenyan military took control of the port city of Kismayo. But military success does not come without challenges. Mohamed Musa Tere, executive director of the Somali Institute for Policy and Strategic Studies, notes that political disputes can arise quickly when territory is rapidly reclaimed.
What we have realized before, that some area was liberated from Al-Shabaab, but there was not a political strategy in place. And what happened is there was a power vacuum, but also clan infighting.
Kismayo serves as an example. After Al-Shabaab fled the city, a power struggle emerged between the Somali federal government, a Kenyan-backed regional leader, and other local actors. At one point, five different men claimed to be the president of a newly formed state around Kismayo. The next challenge could be Gedo region, which borders both Ethiopia and Kenya in southwestern Somalia, and where AMISOM has seized territory from Al-Shabaab. Tare, who comes from Gedo, sees the possibility of a struggle for influence between Somalia's neighbors.
Because Kenya wants certain people to come forward. Ethiopia may come up with other people, and then you will come and there'll be a circle of conflicts and conflicts and conflicts. If they are not having a common strategy where the government has a role.
In a message earlier this week, Al-Shabaab's leader Ahmed Abdi Godane called on Somalis to take up arms against Ethiopian forces inside Somalia. Despite losing territory to AMISOM in recent years, the militant group has continued to launch suicide attacks against government and international targets, including an assault on the presidential palace in Mogadishu last month that killed at least 17 people. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Coming up on 12 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United Nations is launching a campaign to end the recruitment and use of child soldiers by 2016. It says eight governments on a Security Council list of child recruiters have agreed to sign an action plan to end these violations. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations has a list of 55 parties that recruit child soldiers. Among them are 46 non-state actors and eight governments, including those of Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Yemen. The UN Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict, Leila Zerugi, is spearheading this campaign jointly with the UN Children's Fund. She says the outlook is promising because nations are unanimous that using children to fight in war is unacceptable and must end.
No government in the world is telling us, I have the right to recruit children and to send them fight. It's not your business. No one is telling us this. Out of the eight that are listed, six already signed an action plan with the United Nations, and the two remaining are in a process of finalizing their action plan.
Yemen and Sudan have yet to sign the agreement, but say they are committed to stop the use of child soldiers. They presently are in negotiations with the United Nations to make this happen. The UN Action Plan obliges governments to ban their military from drafting and using child soldiers. It promises to release children from service and to reintegrate them into civilian life. It also calls upon states to criminalize this practice and ensure that no child under 18 is drafted. In the presentation of her annual report to the UN Human Rights Council, Zerugi spoke about the disproportionate and intolerable impact that conflicts around the world have on children. She noted armed conflict has intensified in several countries, most notably in Syria, South Sudan, and Central African Republic. She added that in other countries, thousands of children also are recruited, killed, maimed, raped, and kidnapped. The special representative spent 4 years serving in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. She says she was deeply affected by the terrible stories boys and girls told her about how they had been abducted, recruited, indoctrinated, and used as sex slaves.
Not only girls and boys. That's what happened to them in the bush. They serve as cooks. They serve as porters, they serve as sex slaves, and they are also human shields. That's the reality. You even cannot reintegrate them in their community when they return because you cut the link with the community and the family. It's terrible what happened to these children. And that's why we have all to be united and to work and to make sure that these children will never, ever be recruited, and those who are doing this have to pay a price.
Globally, the number of children recruited as soldiers is estimated between 250,000 and 300,000. Zarugi says governments are more aware of the harm done to child soldiers and of the shame attached to their recruitment. She says governments do not want to remain on the list of recruiters. They want to make sure their ranks are free of children. And this, she says, is what gives her hope that the Children Not Soldiers campaign can ultimately succeed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, IDMC, says women and children make up 70% of the world's internally displaced population, and young girls pay the biggest price of displacement. The organization recently issued a briefing paper entitled Girl Disrupted. It highlights the effects of violence, conflict, and disasters on girls' lives, including education. It also considers gender-based violence, trafficking, forced marriage, and other issues that affect girls. The paper also showcases good practices through stories from the CAR, DRC, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Colombia. It also provides recommendations on girl-specific prevention and response mechanisms. Sophie Crozet is a trainer and legal officer for the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. She spoke with us about the briefing, Girl Disrupted.
Well, in most of the countries that IDMC is monitoring, we know that 70% of the whole displaced community is composed of women and children. And in these countries, women and children usually hold quite a submissive role already and do face some issues, and especially gender inequality when dealing with accessing basic services or basic human rights. Displacement makes it even more difficult for them, and they are much more vulnerable in chaotic displacement environments than they were before. For example, girls in chaotic displacement environments are much more likely to be victims of abuses, especially sexual abuses, especially when they don't have access to shelter or privacy.
Were there any particular countries that stood out where girls were being victimized more so than other places?
In the briefing paper, we tried to show that it does impact girls all over the world. So we have cases from Central African Republic, which is a hot country right now, and that is facing an emergency with more than 700,000 new displaced persons since the beginning of the new crisis. But we also show cases, stories from long-lasting and protracted situations in Palestine or in Afghanistan. Their problems are different, but they do face specific issues that are to be taken into account. For example, we, in this paper, Girl Disrupted, we talk about the terrible issue of early and forced marriages that girls do face, especially in situations of displacement. Unfortunately, it happens also in normal situations, but displacement do make the conditions in which people live much more difficult, and parents lose everything, and especially their jobs and their livelihood during displacement, are sometimes forced to make terrible decisions, and sometimes the decision of marrying a six-year-old little girl, as it's showcased in the story that we gathered from Afghanistan for this report.
What is being done to address the issue of victimizing and traumatizing young girls who are displaced?
In this report, we choose to talk about education in emergency because one of the consequences of displacement is disruption of education. And this leads to, well, disruption of a child's normal life, of education, but also protection issues. While they are not in school, girls are much more likely to be harassed or to be confined at home and even married early. So education on emergency is one of the solutions that should be taken as soon as possible, especially in terms of programming, making sure that these education programs are gender-friendly and tackle the issues of the obstacles to girls' access to school. And we are recommending consultation with local authorities and local leaders in order to ensure that girls go back to school as soon as possible and are able to bounce back and find their childhood again.
That was Sophie Crozet, trainer and legal officer for the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. She spoke with me from Geneva. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 20 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The international community warns that South Sudan faces a possible famine if the conflict there is not quickly brought to an end. Somali and African Union forces say they have reclaimed more territory from the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab in renewed military operations across Somalia. And young girls face extreme hardship when they are forced to flee their homes because of violence and conflict. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. A new report says ending persistent hunger and undernutrition should be top development priorities. The International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, has released its annual Global Food Policy Report. VOA's Joe DiCapua has details.
IFPRI has set a goal of 2025 for ending hunger and undernutrition. The UN estimates more than 840 million people still go hungry every day, while over 2 billion have a deficiency of essential micronutrients, such as iron, vitamin A, and zinc. Although very high, those figures actually represent an improvement in recent years, but the progress has not been uniform. The report says there are still major hunger challenges in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Shengen Fan is IFPRI Director General.
We have made tremendous progress in the last several decades. So poverty has come down, undernutrition has come down. However, we are still facing some tremendous challenges.
Fan says solving hunger and undernutrition is a moral issue.
We got to work together to solve that problem. Secondly, it is also an economic issue. It makes a lot of economic sense by reducing hunger and malnutrition.
He says there is a very large return for every dollar invested in reducing hunger. The IFPRI report lists Brazil, China, Thailand, and Vietnam as having made dramatic progress with policies that emphasize improving agriculture, providing social safety nets, and targeting nutrition programs at those most in need. Fan says it requires cooperation among governments, the private sector, civil society, farmers, and others.
So you have different kinds of approaches that can reduce hunger, malnutrition in a short period of time, let's say in 20 years, even 10 years. Why I'm pushing for 2025 is because if we keep the current momentum, the momentum we have created in the last 2 or 3 years, put nutrition very high in development agenda, I believe we can do it by 2025.
The report says, however, that the development agenda should not pursue the achievement of environmental sustainability goals at the expense of food and nutritional security and the well-being of poor and hungry people.
Why we need a sustainable world is because we wanted to have a sustainable world for people, but it must be people-focused. However, if we do not tackle some of the environmental issues, climate change issues, then obviously people will suffer. So yes, in many areas, there may be some trade-offs. However, there are many synergies as well. How can we produce enough nutritious food by using less water, less land, emit less carbon emission? So there are lots of synergies.
Fan says new priorities must be set as the Millennium Development Goals come due. The MDGs, which include reducing hunger, will expire at the end of next year. He says so far there's nothing official to replace them, but meetings are underway to do so.
There are many, many different working groups led by UN, by a high-level panel, by civil societies, by many different groups. So 2014 will be a critical year for different stakeholders to make their contribution to the debate. So finally, it is the national governments who have to own this strategy, who have to own the agenda. So So unless they own it, I'm afraid the goals we set will not be achieved.
The IFPRI Director General says it's a matter of political will, accountability, and adequate resources. He adds, besides the current focus on staple crops, maize, rice, and wheat, emphasis must also be placed on more nutritious foods, such as vegetables and fruits. He also warns against the current trend in many developing countries of eating more processed foods containing large amounts of fat, sugar, and salt. He says this can lead to the double dilemma of obesity and undernutrition. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Nigeria's president ordered an investigation of the state-owned oil company today over allegations of $20 billion in missing revenues. President Goodluck Jonathan demanded a forensic audit of the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, the NNPC, by independent international firms. Ex-Central Bank Governor Namido Sanusi alleged the missing revenues to Parliament 2 weeks ago. The president's office said the charges were patently not true. The NNPC, a public agency long accused of mismanaging the nation's vast oil revenues, also denied any irregularities. A Senate committee is investigating the charges. Since taking office, the president ordered three probes of reports of rampant NNPC corruption. No results have been disclosed. President Jonathan suspended Sanusi after the central bank governor made the charges. The president said Sanusi's suspension had nothing to do with his NNPC testimony. He charged Sanusi with financial recklessness and gross misconduct. Sanusi said he will challenge the constitutionality of his suspension. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
In Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me. I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The international community warns that South Sudan faces a possible famine if the conflict there is not quickly brought to an end. Somali and African Union forces say they have reclaimed more territory from the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab in renewed military operations across Somalia. And young girls face extreme hardship when they are forced to flee their homes because of violence and conflict. Coming up, music and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, and happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand the March monthly rankings tops your sports report this evening.
Kim, world football's governing body, FIFA, released its latest set of monthly rankings on Thursday. Let's take a look at the top 10 African teams, according to FIFA. The Elephants of Ivory Coast remain number one on the continent, and they're 24th overall. Now, the World Cup-bound Elephants have held the top position in Africa for almost 3 years. I scrolled through the various FIFA rankings, and neighboring Ghana was the last African team to be number one before Ivory Coast back in May 2011. Algeria is number two in Africa in the March FIFA rankings, the same position they were at last month. The Algerians are 25th overall, and like Ghana and Ivory Coast, the Desert Foxes of Algeria have qualified for June's World Cup in Brazil. Another North African team, Egypt, is ranked third on the continent and is 26th overall. The Egyptians were one of the big movers in the rankings, jumping 12 places from February. The Cape Verde Islands are ranked fourth in Africa and 33rd overall, followed by Ghana, Tunisia, and African champion Nigeria. Rounding out the top 10 African teams in the March FIFA rankings, we have Cameroon, Guinea, and Mali. Now, I know our many VOA football fans in Nigeria are scratching their heads and saying, Sonny, how is it possible that the African champion and World Cup-bound Super Eagles of Nigeria are ranked only seventh in Africa? Tough question to answer. And about all I can say is that these FIFA rankings take into account points earned over a four-year period. It's a four-year cycle, and the number of points that a team earns depends on several factors, including match result, importance of the match, and the strength of the opposing team. In terms of match importance, FIFA says a team can earn 1 point for a friendly match, but a FIFA World Cup qualifier has more importance and is worth 2.5 points. Taking a quick look at the very top of the FIFA rankings, reigning World Cup champion Spain remains number one, followed by Germany and Argentina. And remember, VOA World Cup fans, Germany and Argentina have both been grouped with African teams at Brazil 2014. The Germans have been placed in what many are calling the proverbial group of death, along with Portugal, Ghana, and the USA. And the two-time World Cup champion, Argentina, is grouped with Nigeria, Iran, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Joining us now with more African football news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Malawi has pulled out of the qualifying contest for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The Football Association of Malawi president Walter Nyimilandu revealed in Lilongwe on Wednesday. He clarified that this measure is due to lack of funds to honor their fixtures during the qualifiers. Instead, Malawi will focus on the under-20 competitions and grassroots development. On a more cheerful note, the Uganda national football team, the Cranes, has secured over $365,000 $1 million in sponsorship from the Uganda National Insurance Corporation, NIC, ahead of the qualifiers for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The NIC Managing Director for Layan Bayo told the Kampala media on Wednesday. Uganda Football Federation head Moses Magogo says 33 members of the Cranes playing unit and technical crew will enjoy insurance cover. He says this is an important motivation for the team. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Senate is set to approve a budget of US$12 million for the Nigeria Super Eagles 2014 World Cup campaign in Brazil. The Nigeria Senate Committee on Sports and Social Development head Adamu Ibrahim Gumba revealed in Abuja on Wednesday. He showered praise on the work of the Nigeria Football Federation, who over the past 2 years has presided over significant success in Nigeria's international campaigns. These include winning the Orange Africa Cup of Nations, the FIFA Under-17 World Cup, and Nigeria's qualifying for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. In addition, Nigeria has also qualified for the FIFA Women's Under-17 and Under-20 World Cup. Adamu says these successful feats have persuaded the Senate to look favorably at the Federation's budget request for the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. Finally, a Confederation of African Football inspection team led by South African Molefe Olifant, began on Wednesday a four-day inspection tour of Namibia's preparation to host the Africa Women's Championships in October. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled, Ayanle Suleiman Earns Athletic Glory for Djibouti. And I write about the 21-year-old athlete who won the men's 1500 meters gold medal at the recent World Indoor Championships in Poland. It marked the first time Djibouti's national anthem was played for a gold medal winner at a World Athletics Championship. Suleiman says he started running after watching the 2008 Beijing Olympics on television. He says he wanted to compete at the 2012 London Olympics, but a leg injury sidelined those Olympic dreams. Now Suleiman appears ready to run for a medal in 2016 when he makes his Olympic debut in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sonny, and good evening to all our listeners around Africa.
David, if you were a goalkeeper, I think we can say you pitched a shutout in terms of the latest African football quiz, a true stumper, no correct answers. Fill us in on that, David, and give us the correct answer.
Yeah, Sonny, I finally conquered all those very clever football supporters, particularly in Nigeria. They've always managed to score a few goals against me, but this time, as you said, Sonny, I'm very proud to say a clean sheet. The correct answer, Sonny, is KMKM. Now, let me explain. Formerly, Tanzania and Zanzibar. Zanzibar is an island off the coast of Tanzania, and the clubs from the island and also from the mainland of Tanzania, they played in the same league. And in 1985, KMKM, they won the title, and therefore they represented Tanzania in the CAF Champions League, or as it was known then, the African Champions Cup. And then fast forward to 2014, and we did drop that hint, KMKM represented Zanzibar, because Zanzibar now are entitled to send their own clubs into the African competitions. They went out, unfortunately, in the preliminary round. They were beaten by Dedebit of Ethiopia. We had a lot of interesting answers, including TP Mazembe. We had Al Hilal of Sudan. We had Hearts of Oak of Ghana. But the only club that has represented two members of CAF are KMKM. They've represented Tanzania, and then they represented Zanzibar in the Premier African Club competition. But many thanks, Ali. We got an awful lot of entries, and a lot of the people sent very nice messages to me with their entries. They were all, of course, convinced that they had the correct answer. But alas, nobody got it, Sonny. Correct answer for the final time, KMKM of Tanzania formerly and now Zanzibar.
And yes, we will have some more African football quiz questions in the future, so stay tuned. I know David is already thinking of his next stumper.
Definitely, Sonny. Definitely. I'm going to spend a couple of weeks, and I'll come up with one that will keep those listeners of ours busy. Oh, Africa,
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Cause
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Hi. I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
Let the games begin, Shegun. Finally, in National Basketball Association news, the Los Angeles Lakers say injured star guard Kobe Bryant is done for the season. The decision to end Kobe's 18th NBA season was long expected. A broken bone in Kobe's left knee has kept him off the court since December. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up in part four of our series on China and Africa, we'll examine why more Africans are going to China to make a living. And we'll find out what happened to Nigeria's once flourishing textile industry. First, some music. Here's the artist for Haiti with We Are the World.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one. There are people dying.
Oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life, the greatest gift of all.
We can't go on pretending day by day
that someone somehow will soon make a change.
We are all a part of God's grace.
know love is all we need.
We are the ones. We are the chicken dream. We are the ones to make a brighter day. Students start giving.
There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's true, we'll make a better day. Just you and me.
So their cries for help will not be in vain.
We can't let them suffer. No, we cannot turn away.
Right now, they need a helping hand.
No se mundo. We are the children.
We are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start giving.
Artist for Haiti with We Are the World. Well, one aspect of the rapidly increased trade between Africa and China is that more Africans are going to China to make a living. But it's not all strictly business. During the day, Nigerian entertainer Diba Ocha buys and sells hair extensions. At night, he sings and produces his own songs to break into China's music market. It's a challenge that reflects a broader issue of China's ability to increase its soft power in Africa. Ricky Shryock brings us the fourth in a series of reports on Chinese dreams.
That was a single from Diba Ocha, a Nigerian-born singer. The entertainer is currently working on a second album. Only this one will be in Chinese.
I want everything to be sung in Chinese, which I'm working hard to. I have some projects at hand that I want to finish up.
Diba Ocha lives in the Chinese city of Guangzhou. According to the musician, Nigerian singers in China, such as Hao Go, have had success because they sing well-known Chinese songs. He says the Chinese dream, often touted as an idea of economic prosperity, whether it be individually or collectively through Chinese channels, has eluded him so far.
Yeah, actually, it's a little bit difficult for me to break through, though I have some fans online, but it's not making the wave. So I think the best thing I have to do is to go back to Africa, where I come from. Probably I can make it. I can get what I'm looking for. But
Dibaucha is still positive.
Definitely, African can make a living in China. It depends on the role you are playing here. For those who are doing business, China is a very good place as a business opportunity.
Roberto Castillo is a researcher from Lingyan University who lives in Guangzhou and studies African migrants living in the region. He says he is surprised by the amount of Africans in the city and the way they are able to reach out to the Chinese populations, especially when it comes to languages. Castillo adds that most Africans living in the area are not immigrants, but rather they are moving back and forth between China and Africa.
I call them transnational entrepreneurs, and they're people with money, not a lot of money sometimes, with certain amounts of money that they come and do business. They're not coming to China to look for work or to look for like low-skilled, you know, positions. They're coming and investing here and buying things and moving things back to China, to Africa.
This movement reflects the rapidly expanded economic relationship between Africa and China, which is now the continent's largest trading partner. As Chinese investment in Africa continues to rise, the country is also trying to increase its soft power throughout the continent through cultural exchange. In Senegal, for instance, a Chinese-produced show, dubbed in French as Dudu et ses belles-mères, recently began playing on a channel in the West African country. For singers like Dibaucha, trends such as this could mark a way into the bigger marketplace. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Dakar.
Thank you, Ricky. And for more on our feature series, log on to our website at www.voaafrica.com. Nigeria's once flourishing textile industry collapsed years ago. Now some former factories are decaying from lack of use. Some blame the closures on Chinese products, others on mismanagement and lack of government support. Heather Murdoch reports from Kaduna.
For the first time in more than a decade, these former textile workers are touring their old factory. Machines are decaying, and bits of cloth and other junk litter what used to be one of the largest factories in Nigeria. Wardem Simdik is chairman of the Coalition of Closed Unpaid Textile Workers in Kaduna.
Here in Kaduna, there is no other job that these people are doing. The only job we are doing here is Okada's job. These people that ride motorcycle here and there. And at the end of the day, some of them, they got accident, they died.
Most of the clothes for sale in Nigeria are imported from China. Industry leaders say their low cost helped drive the textile factories out of business. But they stress that corruption, mismanagement, and lack of resources are equally to blame for the industry's collapse. Umar Mohammed, the former deputy secretary of the Textiles Workers Union, says they warned the government for years that without help, the factories would close.
Then at last, the industry will start collapsing one by one. To the extent today, in Kaduna, we have only two industries working, textile industry.
At the factory, former workers say about 9,000 of their ranks are waiting for back pay in Kaduna alone. And they insist that if the factories reopen, the locally made clothes will outsell the lower cost imports.
It was just mismanagement. Mismanagement. When I was working, even our produce, people we are waiting to collect, people we are rushing to buy, We are unable to meet up with the demands.
Workers say failed industry in Kaduna affected more than the economy. This bridge separates Kaduna City, which is divided like the country as a whole, with mostly Christians in the south and mostly Muslims in the north. Clashes between the two groups are common. But former textile workers and their families say the violence is fueled by poverty that has intensified since the jobs disappeared. They fight for even small sums of money.
No help. Everybody is going over and down. Everybody has mind their business.
because we don't have. That's why everybody run, go and down to fight to get something to eat.
Former textile workers say they will continue to protest outside the old factories and lobby for back pay. But returning to their jobs, they say, is still the dream. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Kaduna.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wayne Shorter, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some of the world's busiest shipping lanes trace along the northwestern Arabian Sea, where it laps the Horn of Africa and narrows toward the Gulf of Aden. Since the second phase of the Somali Civil War began around 2005, this area has been teeming with pirates. In 2008 alone, pirates launched 111 attacks on ships, 42 of which succeeded. The ships and their crews were hijacked and held for ransom. The pirates upped the ante in 2009. The rate of attacks increased tenfold in January and February of that year, as compared to the same period in 2008. Seeking to stop the hijackings, the international community established in January 2009 the Contact Group on Piracy off of the coast of Somalia. This diverse group brought together numerous countries, international and non-governmental organizations, to coordinate their efforts to counter piracy off the Horn of Africa. Since then, the Contact Group has grown to an open and vital architecture of 80 nations and organizations, including the entire spectrum of stakeholders, different ministries, international and non-governmental organizations, many sectors of the maritime industry, and representatives of civil society, said Donna Hopkins, U.S. State Department Coordinator for Counterpiracy and Maritime Security. The figures speak for themselves. There has been no piracy hijacking off the coast of Somalia since May 10, 2012, over 20 months. This is the lowest rate of attempted hijackings in over 6 years, and certainly since the peak of the crisis in 2011. This remarkable turn of events is due not only to the multinational counter-piracy operations preventing and disrupting pirate attacks, but also because commercial ships are helping by protecting themselves, including the use of armed security teams. Nonetheless, though the situation has improved, passage through the area is still dangerous. The group continues to prevent pirate attacks at sea, but it also works to undermine support for the pirates on shore and works with the Somali government to offer alternative employment to would-be pirates. This is an international law enforcement effort to bring to justice the handful of kingpins who operate this terrible enterprise, said Donna Hopkins. The fundamental conditions along the Somali coast have not yet changed, and if we drop our guard, piracy will return.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.